Yeah, I think the hang-up would be the part where you intentionally infect humans and then treat them.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to People, Parasites, and Plagues, a podcast aimed at delivering information about the fascinating pathogens among us from the scientists who study them. I am Kim Klonowski.
And I am David Peterson, your host for today's episode. Today, we'll delve into the world of all things Trypanosoma cruzi from a guest who has spent his entire career working on the elusive parasite.
Our guest today is Dr. Rick Tarleton, Regents Professor and UGA Athletic Association Distinguished Professor in the Department of Cellular Biology and founder and member of the Center for Tropical and Emerging Global Diseases. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. A pleasure to be here.
And we should note right away that we are just 2 days away. April 14th is World Chagas Disease Day. So I don't know, do we congratulate you or...
We may have stumped him on the first question.
Yeah. not a.
I'm not going to take that bait.
Not a celebratory thing. So, Rick, one thing we'd like to ask our guests is about their journey into science, and we've got some really interesting answers in the past. And we'd like to ask you how you ended up from an undergrad somewhere into your current research career.
It was a pretty straight path for me as an undergrad at Wake Forest. I also spent time during the summers and on breaks working in hospitals because I thought I was on a pre-med destiny. And I discovered pretty quickly that I didn't want to be a physician and then looked for other options for somebody interested in science and biology in particular. And the best option I could find at Wake Forest, a small college, was Ray Kuhn's lab, and Ray worked on Trypanosoma cruzi. And so I started as an undergrad in his lab, and yeah, I took a few side roads, short forays into other subjects along the way, but essentially have spent the last 45 or more years working on T. cruzi. From that, Ray was a very dynamic and inspiring mentor, probably the only, well, certainly the largest scientific influence on me, and just instilled with me a great interest and excitement about science and about this subject in particular.
You know, I should note that we recently had a grad student defend her dissertation, and she also credited Ray with getting her interested and involved in science and research on parasitology. So his impact goes on.
Yeah, well, he was a professor for 50 years and just retired very recently. So he had a long and wide impact from a fairly humble beginning, somebody who wasn't trained in parasitology or immunology.
So before we get started, in a few sentences, can you tell our listeners about the prevalence of T. cruzi and the disease pathology of Chagas disease?
Yes. So this is a infection that is restricted to the Americas, and that's primarily because of the vector bug that transmits it is also restricted to North, Central, and South America. Those bugs are primarily in temperate areas, so they don't overwinter in the northern U.S., so you don't see T. cruzi or transmission in those areas or the far south of South America, but everywhere in between, so the southern U.S. to near the tip of South America. And its impact as a human infection, it's a little unclear. You know, the statistics that are quoted are 6 to 8 million people are infected, but there's really very little assessment of those numbers. And so those are not dependable. And more importantly, or as importantly, very large numbers of animals. So it's an infection that is not just a human infection, but is the same parasite, the same vectors transmit to a large number of wildlife and domestic animals.
So we don't hear a lot about Chagas disease in the United States, and I'm assuming that's in part because of the vector, but you also said it's in the southern United States. So Is it something that we're hearing more about maybe in the veterinary world and I'm just missing, or?
Well, you don't hear so much about it because as a human transmittable disease in the infection in the U.S., it's a very rare thing because of the way it's transmitted. And essentially, it's dependent on very close association with the insects and the animals or the people that become infected. And in the southern U.S. and the rest of North America, northern part of North America, housing is such that people don't generally encounter the insect. That's not the case in large areas of Central and South America. This is a disease of poverty and people who live in low-income areas and with substandard, what we'd consider substandard housing, have a greater chance of encountering the insect and therefore a greater chance of becoming infected in terms of humans. Animals are a whole different set, because wildlife that is outside, or even domestic animals, like if you have dogs that spend a lot of time outside, they're very commonly infected in the U.S. So there are areas in Texas, for instance, where we study dog populations where 50% of the dogs are infected with T. cruzi, and 20 to 30% new infections per year in groups of animals. So it's very much present in the U.S. It's very much transmissible in the U.S. It's not commonly transmitted to humans because we don't have the bugs normally in our housing. And unlike dogs, we don't eat the bugs. Dogs like to eat big, fat, blood-fed bugs, and they do, and they get infected by doing that.
And we should clarify that you can't catch this from your dog, right?
That is correct. And so for example, these areas in Texas where we have, it's a good example of the transmission, that these areas where we have large numbers of dogs, these are working dogs that are on like hunting ranches and very well cared for, lots of human interactions between those dogs and their caretakers. None of those caretakers are infected because they're not behaving like the dogs are, which is licking when they've been bitten or ingesting bugs directly. So in the U.S., there is risk of infection because there are infected dogs, animals, and insects, but the risk to humans is really very low unless you're spending large amounts of time sleeping outdoors. And, you know, if you're camping in an area where there's lots of insects, there is potential. But again, the transmission, this is an insect that transmit not through the bite, but through defecating after feeding or during feeding. So it's a very inefficient form of transmission. You can be bitten many, many, many times by insects that are infected and not become infected yourself. So again, that's another reason transmission is just incredibly inefficient to humans, which makes it fairly remarkable that even, you know, 6, 8, 10 million people are infected because they do have frequent encounters with insects and either ingest the feces or the bugs will defecate on food. And there's a, you know, more complex transmission cycle in areas where there's lots of insects and they're in the house all the time.
So you mentioned dogs in the U.S., and I guess they're a major host throughout the Americas, but if I recall, T. cruzi can infect just about any vertebrate. Is that correct?
Mostly mammals. So it doesn't survive in birds, for example. The insects like to feed on birds, but the parasite isn't transmitted readily. For example, again, referring to places in Texas where you find these high number of infections in dogs, that's because there's a high number of infections in the wildlife that's around the areas where the dogs are. So if you sample the raccoons or the rats or other rodents in that area, you're going to find also 50, 60, 70% infections in those animals.
I think it was Michael Yabsley here at UGA that had done some survey work on raccoons and other things in the Southeast and found a fairly high prevalence of it. And yet I haven't heard information about infections in dogs in the Southeast. Is that just because we haven't looked?
Yes, primarily. There has been sampling done in most states in the Southeast. And if you essentially average across all those studies, depending on various areas, it's somewhere between 2 and 5% of dogs in the southern U.S. that have T. cruzi infection. And again, you know, if you have a dog that spends all its time indoors on the carpet, it's not going to have a high chance of being infected. But if it spends a lot of time outdoors, the chances are greatly increased. So we do have infected dogs that show up in vet offices in Athens and, you know, around Georgia and all the southern states.
So let's talk a little bit more about these natural infections in dogs. Is studying T. cruzi in dogs a good model for humans?
That's one of the really nice things about T. cruzi in general, is because it is such a generalist in terms of animals, mammals that it infects. Essentially, the same parasites infect all of these different animals, and the response in all these different animals is essentially the same. Dogs tend to have a greater chance of having a more highly impacted acute infection because they may get infected with a higher number of parasites initially. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you know, what happens in them is essentially the same as what happens in humans and in other animals. So it's, you know, from a scientific point of view, it's a fantastic aspect of studying this parasite that you have many other accessible, naturally infected hosts like dogs and also non-human primates that are in primate facilities that one can learn from when studying things in humans is either inaccessible or unethical. Mm-hmm. So yes, dogs, we're especially in this area in Texas where we have very high transmission pressure. There's some questions there, scientific questions that we're really excited to try to understand. You know, in particular, one thing that's not known about human infections is if you have an infection and you are lucky enough to have it treated and cured, are you resistant to reinfection? That is not known. Mm-hmm. And this is a population where that question could be answered quite readily.
That would be a very tough question to answer in human studies.
Absolutely. Although I have to say that one of the problems in working with Chagas disease is that there are not a lot of people that do it, and there's not a lot of appreciation for it. And getting funding for it is a little challenging. And that study that we proposed to do in dogs is now in its fifth submission for funding. And some of the critiques have been, well, you should really do this in humans. It's a little frustrating sometimes to deal with those sorts of responses to what you think are pretty well-designed studies.
Yeah, I think the hang-up would be the part where you intentionally infect humans and then treat them.
Well, no, you wouldn't have to do that. You could treat them, but then you have to put them back into a place where they have a high chance of being reinfected when you know you could avoid that. That's a little problematic.
Yeah. So you have worked on a lot of different areas related to T. cruzi, immunology, of course, which is primarily how I think of your research, but you've also done work on diagnostics and recently and excitingly on drug discovery. So how is it that you kind of spread out into these things? Was it through collaborations or were it things that you actively pursued because there were good opportunities?
Well, it's a combination of things. You know, my start in working in T. cruzi immunology, as I said, came from inspiration from undergraduate work with Ray Kuhn. And, you know, in the early years, what I really enjoyed was the scientific challenge and the basically puzzle solving that two very complex things, the immune system and a complex parasite. And it was, you know, extremely fun and exciting to study this just as a, you know, a scientific problem. But as I started to sort of expand and particularly developing collaborations in Argentina, where I would now start to see people with human infection, not just mice that we were infecting in the lab and say, oh, isn't it cool that this immunological phenomenon happens? Now seeing humans that were infected for 20 years and weren't getting effective treatment or diagnostics, I started to think about things that we could do that would be equally interesting but more high impact. So I sought out some collaborations. The drug discovery business, you know, I got into that not because I know anything about drug discovery and I'm a terrible biochemist, but we knew how to determine if drugs were effective in the animal models that we worked in. And so we collaborated with very good medicinal chemists. And, you know, that combination of having somebody who knew a lot about the biology and the course of infection and had access to models and could actually determine very rigorously whether something worked or not, and good chemists who could design the right compound and optimize it, led to a really great end product, I believe.
So what's the current situation with drugs to cure Chagas disease, and what are the challenges that you're facing to develop new drugs?
Well, there are two currently used drugs that have been around for almost 50 years now, nifurtimox and bisnidazole. I think it can best be described as they have undependable efficacy. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. There's a problem with even understanding if they did work or not. That's another issue with Chagas. But they're not used partly for that reason, partly because they have a high, relatively high 20% or so adverse events rate. So 20% or so of people who begin a course of treatment, which is a long-term course, 60 days, can't finish that treatment course and therefore have a lesser chance of it being effective. New drug discovery has been challenging, I think mainly because of science that hasn't been done incredibly well. There have been a number of new drugs put into clinical trials, but in my mind, those clinical trials failed. And I think they failed because they didn't take advantage of the advantages we have in T-cruzy to really validate that something would work. They put it in mice and said, looks like it could work. Let's try it in humans. And those failed. So I think, you know, the field has shot itself in the foot a few times in trying to develop new drugs. And that's sort of created the aura that this is an infection that it's just going to be impossible to develop new drugs for. And I think we're proving that's not the case, that if you're much more careful and much more rigorous and take real advantage of the positives that this infection brings, and primarily that's models like a dog or a non-human primate that's naturally infected, that has a diversity of genetic types of parasites, have different genetics themselves, is as similar to humans as you can get, and are also in need of treatment. You can use those to really vet, no pun intended, drugs that then could be used and have a greater chance of working in humans. So in terms of development, I think we just have to be smarter about how we progress things before putting them into human clinical trials.
So drug development is difficult for all parasitic diseases. And one of the reasons, I think, is that people may not realize that, but compared to viruses or bacteria, protozoan parasites are eukaryotes. They're more similar to us. And I guess that's one of the challenges that you face. Are there others as well?
I think that's the case in all protozoan parasites, malaria, toxo, T. cruzi, leishmaniasis, African trypanosome. So they're much more complicated and also much more similar to humans, but they have unique, you know, very unique biologies. There's a bunch of different ways to do drug discovery. I'm not an expert on that, but I think there's some simple things one can do. And one of the things that we did, and again, taking advantage of the tools we had in T. cruzi, is that we worked with good chemists, and we also very quickly put compounds into animals, into mice, in a very rapid short-term assay to determine if they had a potential to work. So instead of saying, okay, here's a compound that works in culture and doesn't work you know, it's not going to be so good in humans or in animals because we're going to have to optimize it for this. We went straight from saying, okay, here's something that works in culture. Does it work in an animal? And then took those, you know, we certainly lost some good compounds because that could be optimized further. But taking those, we skipped over the step of optimizing something for use and then having it really not work. We started with things that we knew worked well enough in mice and then could spring off of that. And honestly, I think that increased the speed with which we could get to compounds that had really good potential. So again, that's another advantage of working in T. cruzi as opposed to like malaria, where you can't easily just test something in a mouse that's going to work against a human parasite that won't grow in mice.
So we spent some time talking about dogs. I'm just going to pop back to humans for a second. So a person infected with T. cruzi tends to have, I believe, a fairly long acute illness where they have high parasitemia in the blood. Is that correct?
They have a period. Okay. It's actually not well documented. You know, if you have a human that's in an acute infection, in most cases, you don't monitor disease.
Right.
You know, you treat that.
Right.
So, I mean, we do have drugs to treat that, and they work, you know, much better in the acute phase than or at least they appear to work better there. But in animals, the infection is relatively high parasite numbers for the first or so. And then that infection comes under control by generation of potent immune responses and is reduced to very low levels, but it's frequently, almost never is it cleared completely. So most people that become infected, in the case of humans, they will have an acute phase of infection that, depending on the load of parasites they were infected with, oftentimes they don't know they're infected. Mm-hmm. The symptoms are very nondescript. They might feel bad for a couple of days, think they have a cold or the flu or something like that. But the immune response to Trypanosoma cruzi is really robust if you have a competent immune system. And in the vast majority of individuals, that acute phase infection is very well controlled. But the long-term problem is that the parasite hangs around. And so it's 10, 20, 30 years later when these parasites that, this is an intracellular parasite and invades host cells, it tends to persist in muscle and destroys muscle in the process. And one of those muscles that gets destroyed is the heart. So frequently disease manifests as heart disease, but it may not occur until decades after the initial infection.
Yeah, so this is kind of where I was wanting to go. So the first question is why can't the immune system control the infection? And then the second question is why the muscle?
Yeah.
Is the parasite evolved to evade the immune system by going into the muscle?
So those are both great questions, and they're questions that I've worked for 40 years on. And David mentioned that drug discovery is difficult. That was easy compared to understand the answer to these questions. So I think those two questions go hand in hand, or the answer to them is similar. So the parasite persists in muscle, and muscle is a nice place for an intracellular parasite because muscle is somewhat of an immune privileged site. So in terms of expression of pathogen molecules that are required for recognition by the immune system that there's a parasite within a cell, muscle is more like cells in the testes or the brain, where the idea is you need an immune response, but you don't want an overactive immune response because you can't afford to destroy your brain or your reproductive organs if you want to propagate, or your heart if you want to survive. And so the basic idea that we're coming to is that, so the parasite has adapted to be in muscle because it can evade the immune system pretty efficiently there. Not totally efficiently, but our recent studies suggest that cells that we always thought could kill parasite-infected cells, they do really well with the parasites in another type of cell, like a macrophage or a fibroblast. But when they're in muscle, those T cells, those cytolytic T cells, can't really see infected muscle. And so the control there isn't through recognition and killing. It's through cytokine production by those T cells, but that is a less efficient way of controlling the parasite. It keeps the parasite numbers down, but it, in most cases, isn't sufficient to actually clear the parasites from that tissue. So it's almost, you know, I look at it as it like a game of whack-a-mole, where you have a few parasites in an area. The T cells come in, they make enough cytokines that the parasites get controlled there. But in the meantime, parasites have been released from that area. They go to a new site where, again, they start the cycle over again. They kill host cells, elicit inflammation, get controlled there. But they're always a step ahead of the immune response. And it's a very robust immune response, so that the parasite has found a niche where it can survive even at a low level and continue to be transmitted long term.
Right, because I think we need to remind our listeners that for many of these organisms, they don't want to kill their hosts. They want a place to be able to live long term, right? So to find a niche like that is key.
So I'm almost afraid to ask this question because I'm in a small room with two card-carrying immunologists. So I'm
not sure I carried my card anymore.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's all digital these days.
Yes.
I think it's been revoked because I did drug discovery.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. But with some diseases and things like COVID or the flu come to mind, a lot of the lung pathology is due to the immune response. If you think back to the 1918 flu epidemic that for some weird reason hit younger people with strong responsive immune systems the hardest, is that a contributing factor to the heart disease with T. cruzi, or is it just the parasite invading, destroying muscle cells?
Well, that's been an area of controversy and a lot of discussion in the Chagas field for a long time. Historically, what people that had T. cruzi infection or Chagas disease, they were sent to cardiologists because they had cardiac insufficiencies as a result. So instead of going to an infectious disease doc, they're sent to a cardiologist to manage this. And cardiologists would look at the tissues of their patients that died and said, okay, look, there's all this inflammation and we don't see any parasites there. This must be an immune-mediated disease. And when I entered the field, that was the dogma, was that this was really an autoimmune disease, that the immune system had gone kind of wacky and the parasite had elicited that, but it wasn't actively maintaining that destruction and inflammation in the tissue. What we've learned since then is through a lot of work that that's not really the case, that if you look globally in a tissue like the heart, so you can see areas where there's a lot of inflammation and you don't see any parasites. But the parasites in that area have been controlled, as I mentioned earlier. The cells come in there, they make enough cytokines, they stimulate cells to kill the parasites. But if you go to a distant area, you'll see parasites there that have not yet elicited that sort of inflammation. So yes, the immune system is playing a role in disease because it is generating inflammation. It is killing host cells to some degree. But the other option is not to do that. So if you suppress that immune response, parasite numbers go through the roof very rapidly. So it's not a disease. I think the important thing from a operational point of view is that it's not a disease that could be managed by suppressing the immune system. That has the opposite impact that one would want it to have. It exacerbates disease because it increases parasite load.
Okay, I think for one last question, I just wanted to ask you about, you know, clearly your passion for T. cruzi research and understanding the disease and helping others runs pretty deep. And it's therefore may not be surprising to learn that you founded the Chagas Disease Foundation a number of years ago. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I wish there was more to tell about it. I mean, it basically is a foundation that's me. I have a few people that donate to it. In the past, we've mainly spent our money on bringing people together in the scientific field to primarily to enhance drug discovery. And that was one of the factors that got me into that area and that lined me up with the appropriate collaborators that led to, I think, a successful outcome. The science part of Chagas and T. cruzi is difficult, but I think even more difficult is going to be, even if we have diagnostics, which I think we have good enough diagnostics, even if we have drugs, and I think we're on the way to having something that will work really, really well in humans, somebody's got to pay for those things. And so one of the goals, sort of the pipe dream of the foundation right now, is to take advantage of the problem in the U.S. that Chagas disease is, and that is primarily in dogs, an area where one could, through diagnosis and treatment, one could generate income that could offset the cost of diagnosis and treatment in areas of poverty in Latin America that are really affected by this. So a long-term goal of the foundation would be to develop a market for generating income in a society like ours that can afford and wants to provide better health for their animals and needs to, and then use that income to pay for treatment and diagnosis in areas where it's not clear where those funds are going to come from otherwise. So we would love to have some big donors provide some input on those processes, but I think we have a really good, well-mapped out idea implementing it. Well, in the next 40 years of my career, I'll work on that.
Sounds like a plan. Our guest today is Dr. Rick Tarleton from the Department of Cellular Biology and the Center for Tropical and Emerging Global Diseases. Rick, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for your questions.
Links to additional information about Dr. Tarleton's research can be found on our Instagram account at PPPPodcastUGA. Thank you for tuning in today. Please rate the podcast, and if you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us via email at ppp@uga.edu. The podcast is brought to you by the Faculty of Infectious Diseases and the Grady College of Journalism at the University of Georgia. It is supported by the University of Georgia through the Office of Research, the UGA Graduate School, and the College of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to the New Media Institute at Grady for use of their Studio Not Found podcast facilities, and a special thanks to our production assistant, Sid Wigand, for research, editing, scheduling, and keeping us on track.